committee, and let the record reflect that the time is 3:50. The date is March 16, 2005. Members present, Representative Crawford, Lynn, Ledoux, Guttenberg, and myself, Chairman Anderson, and I believe Representative Cott is on his way, and Roeckberg is, I think, on his way as well. We have today three bills, and we're going to try to be aggressive on this because of the lateness of judiciary ending, and I will postpone House Bill 196, Representative Ramirez's bill, until Monday, and we'll take care of any unfinished business on Monday. Today we have House Bill 33, Effects on Regulations on Small Businesses, Representative Myers' bill, and then we have House Bill 182, Wage and Hour Act by the Governor, and House Bill 180, Workers' Comp, Public Testimony. And I intend to postpone House Bill 147 until Friday. That's the insurance bill by the governor. And on Friday, we'll also have House Bill 150, 203, and 216. With that being said, looking at my notes here, also on workers' comp, we're stopping at 4:45 because of floor session. So we will take as much public testimony in between that gap after 33 and 182. So House Bill 33, Mike, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, my name is Michael Kulowski, and I'm an 84 representative Maya. In the interest of time, I will keep my comments brief, but start off by asking that the committee consider the L version of House CS House Bill 3.
Go to L.
Okay, and is that, did we adopt that last time?
That is the latest version responding to questions that were raised in the committee.
Okay, so Representative Lynn, could you move that we have the
yes, Mr. Chairman, adopted. I would move a CF House Bill number 33-24-LS0239-L.
Okay, he's moved that for discussion purposes. No objections. So that version is before the committee. Continue.
Through the chair, Representative Anderson, I believe we have addressed the concerns that the committee brought up. Representative Roeckberg had raised two important clarification points that were covered on page 3 in the G subsection, lines 21 and 22, that while the process described in House Bill 33 doesn't create grounds for judicial review of regulation, judicial review for unrelated provisions is still warranted under the existing Administrative Procedures Act. The other substantive change is on page 4, line 3. And that's include or excluding emergency regulations from the definition of regulation where it applies to this bill. To give the freedom to the agencies that need to adopt something in an emergency where a different process is set up.
Okay.
And the third change really is on page 4, line 7, returning the definition of small business to employing fewer than 100 employees. There is an updated letter from the State Chamber that I believe committee members have in their packets. A model and regulation process chart that we've added so you can see the way House Bill 33 would work. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will yield and answer any questions that I might be able to.
Thank you, Mike. Are there any questions for Representative Myers' aid regarding this legislation? And Representative Roeckberg, you might be the one that should testify if this satisfies your concerns. At least for the record, because I think they made a lot of changes relative to your comments.
No, my discussion with the staff, to Representative Meyer, I think they have done so.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Okay, then what's the next committee of referral for this?
Through the, Mr. Chairman, it's Judiciary and then Finance.
Okay, so it still has two more committees. Representative Guttenberg.
I just had a question. If there's somebody here, the Department of Law possibly that deals with current regulation how it's written.
Is there anyone from the Department of Law?
Yes, this is Chris Kennedy with the Department of Law, Mr. Chairman.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. I see now on my sheet here that you're there. Go ahead, Representative Guttenberg, if you want to read.
Mr. Kennedy, do you have a copy of the bill or the regulatory steps that is illustrated from Mr. Pulaski and Kevin, Representative Meyer's staff?
Representative Guttenberg, Chair, I do not actually have a copy of version L in front of me, but I believe I know how it reads, and I can get a copy of that map very quickly here.
Well,
while you're asking the question.
Thank you. I'm just trying to find out drafting manual for. Now, is this this drafting manual here? And is this the proposed changes or questions you want to ask, or is this existing?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, anything that is not shaded. Okay. Is in the existing drafting manual for administrative regulations. Okay. The shaded is what House Bill 33 would add. At the same time, the underlined for emphasis in number 6 on the shaded on the unshaded side, I underlined that for emphasis.
Okay. So I guess my question is. I'm just trying to find out how easy it is to be complying with these changes in a drafting and writing regs.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, if that's a question for me. I'm not quite sure how to answer it. I think we agree with Representative Meyer that this. Process can be fitted into the regulatory steps the way he has outlined them, and that it doesn't present impossible logistical problems. Certainly, there is it does add a step, and there is a cost to it in terms of involving the DCED in the process, and. So we've addressed the cost in our fiscal notes, although those relate to a slightly earlier version of the bill. But no, I don't think there's a concern that it makes an impossible addition to the regulatory adoption process.
And Mr. Kennedy, this is Chairman Anderson. Just to delineate for the committee members in looking at this document for the record. The drafting manual for administrative regulations isn't codified. It's an instructional, list of elements and areas in which the regulation drafter can follow. And HB 33, I think the comparison in gray is indicating what would be codified and what. Must be directed by the agency to follow in terms of 1, 2, 3, and 4, whether it be identification of of how many small businesses are affected, or number 2, the actual reporting and record keeping elements, or number 3, the probable effects. And so, I mean, isn't that what this sheet is showing?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct that the manual is not law. It's just a manual a guide to help people go through the process. The steps that are in the manual now are mostly prescribed by statute, by the Administrative Procedure Act, and those are reflected in the little numbered boxes that we already have. For example, many of them are required by statute, and then I think the gray boxes and gray arrows indicate the additional steps that would be prescribed by HB 33, and those would also be in statute, but they presumably go into the regulations manual in the same way, as sort of a way of we would probably have a flow chart very much like this in the manual.
Representative,
if I can continue, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Guttenberg, then Crawford.
Thank you. It seems that 1, 2, and 4 are pretty common sense, and they're good things to be talking about when you're drafting regulation. But number 3 is for me is a little problematic. A statement of the probable effect that proposed regulation would have on small businesses whose conduct would be governed by the proposed regulation. I see small businesses like personalities. Everyone is different. They run their operations differently. They do their books differently. They have differing marketing plans. This is one of the things that's a little problematic for me in this bill, is that the conflict between different small businesses and how you would reconcile the differences in regulation.
Mr. Kennedy, can you respond to that? And I think Representative Guttenberg is stating, is that somewhat intangible, and how would that be documented, a statement of probable effect?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I'm in as good a position to respond as Mr. Perlowski to that. I think I'll speculate that the statement of effect would be a page or two of discussion, of thoughtful discussion that would be prepared by the department with the aid of the Department of Law and the DCED employee who would be assigned to manage this small business consultation, and which would discuss the anticipated effects on the small business. I don't think the intent, as we read this bill, is to produce an elaborate study, but rather just to generate some a moment to stop and think about the effects on small business and put that in writing for the public and maybe more importantly the legislature to be able to review.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Crawford, then Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kennedy, the statement that this doesn't create an impossible task, seems to be damning with very faint praise. We've heard in past testimony that you feel that we're already doing these things today, and does this actually constitute a useful exercise? Is there a good reason to put on more people and expend more effort to do this? More so than what we're doing today?
Well, Representative Crawford, through the chair, I think that's getting more into a policy choice that I may not be qualified to speak to in the large sense. I can tell you that it's true that quite a lot of this process is already happening today in an informal way, and that's one of the reasons that it doesn't create an impossible burden. However, as we've said, that it would add a cost, and we're still discussing with the sponsor whether that cost is worthwhile. In many contexts, as I expressed in my testimony last time, we're concerned that this process really might not be terribly useful in the context of regulations, for example, that are only making technical amendments, or that are essentially cleanup projects, or regulations of the fire marshal. So we're still in a dialogue with the sponsor about the question that you raise, I can tell you that we don't feel we've reached a conclusion on that yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kennedy, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
A little bit of a follow-up there.
Sure, of course.
Wouldn't it be beneficial to actually try to reach an agreement and reach a consensus on whether this thing is beneficial rather than going ahead with it? Moving it on to another committee?
Representative Crawford, through the chair, we don't have any objection to moving it to another committee because we feel we're working well with the sponsor and that we're making steady progress, but we certainly leave that to the judgment of this committee whether it would like to hold this matter until that dialogue is concluded, or we can work with Representative Meyer in either committee.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Representative Ledoux.
Well, I guess I was just wondering that since this seems to be an attempt to create business awareness in the regulatory process, why is this just limited to small businesses? Why doesn't it make just equal sense to apply to large businesses, insurance companies, insurance funds? I mean, just sort of anything that's regulated.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think that's a very important point. Business awareness in the regulatory process can add to the process and make the process better. That's the idea behind the bill. The idea in limiting it to a small business is that that's a focused area that involvement with you can make an actual effect. Large businesses, through the public comment process, often have people that they can devote to following regulations, whereas a small businessman who's just trying to do their job wakes up the next day and all of a sudden has to comply with a whole new host of paperwork that they never thought they were going to have to do. But this puts someone in the process that looks out for their interest.
And I think to answer Representative Ledoux's question as well, in my conversation with Representative Meyer, the larger businesses not only have legal counsel and accountants, but they also have associations that can defend their interests, whereas the small business person or the sole proprietor may not have that. And I think that's where we take this in baby steps, and I think it can be expanded, you know, later on into other legislation. But I think this will be a good test case. Are there any other questions for the sponsor or for Mr. Kennedy? Okay, I would just add, kind of in closing comments, that in terms of 1, 2, and 4, I agree with Representative Guttenberg that those are really, really key. But regarding 3, I don't think it's as intangible or difficult to equate, no different than, to keep it in perspective of our environment, Legislative Legal Services gives memorandums on a daily basis and often gives an analysis of a probable effect of legislation, adverse or positive. And also, if you look at a legislative budget and audit report in the blue binders that we get every other month, same thing goes, where there is a probable effect, not literally in that term, but there's an effect equation where they go through in the gray and talk about adverse or positive effects of their audit. So I think that there's examples, and I think that the need of the bill outweighs holding the bill in committee. And so I would entertain, before we get in debate, if there is any, a motion to move the bill out of committee and move on to judiciary. It still has 2 more committees of referral, judiciary and finance. And I have a motion to move House Bill 33 out of committee. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 33 unamended now, with individual recommendations and the attached appropriate fiscal note or notes.
Hey, is there any objection?
No.
Hearing and seeing none, so moved. On to Judiciary Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have House Bill 182, and I mistakenly said it was the governor's bill. Maybe someday Governor Roper, but right now it's Representative Roper's.
You're always looking for...
You weren't here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To speed the process up today, I'll just remain here at the desk, if you don't mind, and make an initial presentation. There are some witnesses that will be coming forward, and I'm sure the committee will be more interested in what they have to say. Mr. Chairman, I am Representative Norman Roper from District 27 in Anchorage and sponsor of House Bill 182. This sets forth some clarifications to the Alaska Wage and Hour Act by basically clarifying and redefining to a limited degree the definitions of executive capacity, administrative capacity, and professional capacity within our code. The primary step of this bill before us eliminates what's known as the long test, or the 80-20 test, or in the retail trade, the 60-40 test. This is an antiquated method of determining eligibility. It's been set aside in most states, and I think Alaska is overdue in taking this up. Also, Mr. Chairman, it does delete the one regulatory definition of what's called supervisory capacity. This is done so because it's pretty unworkable right now, and it's the definition is subsumed under the other categories right now. So this is really a cleanup step. And in addition, it does conform with a standard for qualification of payment of 2 times the Alaska minimum wage, which is a distinction from the Federal Wage and Hour Act that was more recently adopted last year. So that particular provision was worked on and passed by the 23rd legislature, and this bill merely reflects that as a matter of policy here. And so, Mr. Chairman, I just would further point out in your packet is a side-by-side comparison of the current law and the provisions provided in 182. There's also a statement that shows the state-by-state jurisdictional applications of the various forms of Wage and Hour Act, showing that 32 states currently have adopted the federal standards. Eight other states have a short test, such as this bill provides. So in essence, what we're doing in this bill is more closely conforming, but not exactly, to some 40 other states in the United States. This is an important fact because it puts Alaska closer to interpretation of what the Wage and Hour Acts are on an intrastate level or basis. That means when small businesses or businesses want to enter into the state, they don't have an entirely new set of regulations to have to adopt their personnel practices to. So it's a major step forward in that regard. Also, Mr. Chairman, in it is a letter from Anchorage attorney Bill Evans that explains the current legal situation we have in the state of Alaska. So it's very informative, and I think will help the committee members understand the current law and the need for this legislation before us. Also, there's a news article that explains the impact of legislation on small businesses. It's a daily news article about the shutting down of the downtown Lamex restaurant in Anchorage and the amount of obstacles and costs that are almost a direct result of actions of this legislature and other political bodies that have put significant burdens on small businesses over the last decade or so. And I think this particular bill before us is just one very small step, an incremental step at that, that is intended to help assist small businesses in the conduct of their commerce in the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that the bill is supported by the Alaska Hospitality Alliance, which includes the Alaska Beverage Retail and Beverage Association, the Alaska Hotel and Lodging Association, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the State Chamber of Commerce, and other, and a growing list of businesses that cover literally tens of thousands of employees and jobs in the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that the committee list asked Mr. John Sedor to come forward and present some of the more technical aspects of the bill, and perhaps he can be more able to answer some questions about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Roper. A couple housekeeping things. First of
we have a CS.
Could I have a motion from Representative Cott to adopt the CS, which you've
explained? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move we adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 182, version F, Craver 3105, for discussion purposes.
Any objection? Okay, that CS is before the committee. Secondly, I would ask that the committee members who are new or unaware of putting bill packets together to use this as an example, because Representative Roeperg is, after yours truly, the best, or at least we're equal in preparing packets, and this is really good with the comparisons of states and the articles and everything else.
Mr. Chairman, I just make sure that the staff,
you taught me,
the staff get credit for that.
No, but seriously, I'm not on this one. This is,
are you and I putting bill packets together,
whether you're for it or not. Thirdly, I'm looking at the time. We have 30 minutes, and I said I want to adjourn today's meeting at 4:45. So to be honest, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, potentially 8 people to testify. I don't think we'll be getting to workers' comp, the House Bill 180 today, but I want to get to it within the next week, and I want to have amendments within the next week. And even if we have to go late into the night, I plan to have heavy dialogue on that. So I'm not, certainly not holding it for any other reason that we have 30 minutes and then we have to deal with the supplemental budget. So if anyone's here for workers' comp and is uninterested in these, you're welcome to leave, because we will get to that on Friday. And my apologies, but the committees are starting to run into other committees, as happened today. So that gives you a little bit of time that you don't have to waste here. So we have, you said, John Sedor, and just so you know, Gray Mitchell's here, but he's here for questions, and we'll ask him questions if we need to from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. John, if you want to come up, you can be the first to testify on this legislation. State your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is John Sedor, and I am here today speaking on behalf of the Alaska Restaurant and Beverage Association, the Alaska Hotel Lodging Association, the Society of for Human Resource Management, Alaska State Council, which has over 250 business members, the Anchorage Society for Human Resource Members Management, which has over 200 business members. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 182 would address salaried private sector employees. It does not address hourly employees. It instead deals with one aspect of overtime law that you find both under the FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, as well as our state act, which are the exemptions for qualification for salaried basis or being exempt from the overtime statutes. One of the problems with the current state of the law in this state is that the exemptions use the same words. So under both the federal law and the state law, we have exemptions for administrative, executive, and professional, and a few others, but those would be the three primary. It's the same exemption under federal law as state law, but they're deceptively similar. So there's two wholly different tests that apply to each of them. Under the FLSA, you use basically a primary duties test, and Representative Rokeberg addressed that recently as far as 40 jurisdictions use either the current FLSA regulations or use what's called the short test, which uses a primary duties concept. Alaska, when it adopted its regulations, whenever it adopted those regulations, only took what they don't even exist anymore under the federal system, but took one aspect of the federal regulations that had been adopted, in essence, and that's called the long test. And under the long test, the employer has the obligation of showing that 80% of the time that the exempt employee was doing their job, that they were performing what are called exempt duties. Now, that is a very difficult thing to do just out of a business organization aspect, because what happens is, and I'll give you an example, a director who's in charge of 7 stores across South Central Alaska is the director. They're in charge. They have to go from store to store and handle it and make those decisions. Well, if that director makes allegations that he has spent over 20% doing non-exempt duties, such as driving or making coffee or whatever it may be, the employer is exposed for overtime, which, as you know, those penalties are very significant, including liquidated damages and actual attorney fees. What that requires is the employer to have somebody watching these people that by definition and by organization are not being watched, and so it's a time-intensive test. What the federal system now has and what 40 plus other jurisdictions in our country have is a duties-based test where we look at what the person is doing, what their duties are, as opposed to the time they are spending on a particular task. I want to keep my remarks short and answer any questions. I've got other examples. I think that the documents that are in there are explain kind of the differences between what the federal system has and what the state system has. Currently under federal law, it's $455 a week. Under the proposed bill, it would be 2 times the minimum wage. I would note that under the current regulations, outside of service retail sector, there is no minimum that you have to pay. So this addresses that and says if there's something Alaskan about overtime, what it is that we're going to pay at least 2 times minimum wage for that qualification. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, John. Are there any questions, Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, just to point out that under the 2-time rule, by my calculation, Alaska would have a $572 per week minimum floor versus the federal of $455. So that shows one major distinction and differential between the federal standards and the new proposed Alaska rules. I just asked Mr. Sedor if he could just expand a little bit on what the damages could be and typically may be if there was this failure to prove the 80-20 test provisions. In other words, what type of what are the costs or what's the legal exposure to an employer under those types of circumstances?
And Mr. Sedor, maybe you could, in supplement with that or in concert, tell us, this is unique, but you're such an expert in this, tell us what the argument would be against the bill. Just so, and that sounds funny, but yeah. But I just want to hear what we're going to hear, and for someone to say, if you pass this bill, you're going to hurt the employee. I just want to hear what rationale and how you would counter that.
Okay.
So we don't have to bounce back and forth.
Through the chair, I'll address Mr. Representative Roekberg's question first. There's two type of damages that you're exposed to as an employer, especially as a small business employer. The first is the cost of litigation, and what an 80-20 test does is we're talking about time. So we're talking about the time that a salaried exempt employee is doing, and we're talking, there's an old case, the coffee pot case, where the deposition testimony is, I spent 6 minutes in the morning making a pot of coffee. That was actually a Kodiak case. And you end up in these depositions talking about exactly how many minutes in the day, which is a complete antithesis as to what you're really hiring an exempt employee to do, which is to make decisions and to perform the job duties, and then we get back to the primary duties.
Can we get a copy of that case?
I'd have to think about that. So first of all, it's the cost of litigation, because when you have the testimony, when you have somebody saying, I spent more than 20% doing exempt work or doing non-exempt work, and the employer is saying, well, you weren't supposed to be doing that or you didn't, what you have is two factual settings, and you cannot get summary judgment, so you have to go to a trial, so the cost of litigation is significant. The second damages are what we have in statute right now. The damages, if the employee is successful, is the overtime, which for a salaried employee, what you do is generally take their salary, break it down into an hourly rate, multiply by 1.5, and then you double it, and the statute of limitations is generally 2 years, although it can be extended longer than that in certain circumstances. So you double it, and you pay, you know, your interest and actual attorney fees, actual reasonable attorney fees, for the other side, in with some exceptions. So the damages, those significant damages do is force resolution of cases without the employer ever getting their chance to really argue their side of it because of the risk. And so, for instance, I was dealing with a case where the employer wanted to go to trial. They were confident that they could prevail at trial, but at some point they hit the deductible and the insurance company steps in and says, well, we don't want to go on somebody's facts. You know, testimony, he said, she said, or he said, he said. And so then they step in and the employer's kind of squeezed because they can't carry out even what they want to do because of the cost of litigation.
Through the chair, is this sort of thing even covered by insurance?
Sometimes they are. It depends on your policies. You can have policies that cover. And on the other side, I honestly don't know what the argument is on the other side. I'm sure you may hear it. I would say that what this is currently Alaska has two overtime schemes for your small business. They have to comply with the federal, the FLSA, and they have to comply with the state. They're different. So the first question is, why are they different? What is so Alaskan about overtime law? And this bill addresses that, in my opinion, by saying, you know what's Alaskan about overtime is we're going to pay more than the feds. We're going to pay two times minimum wage, which would be more than the $4.55 currently per week that the Fed rules. And I would note just in passing, I do think that bears some attention, is under the current regulations, there is no minimum except for the service retail sector. If you want to go what's called a 60-40 test as opposed to the 80-20, there is no minimum. So currently, arguably, and I'm not aware of any, but just so you know, you could pay minimum wage and have somebody exempt because there is no minimum requirements if you were working under the 80-20 test. So the other thing that you could maybe hear is, you know, this will negatively impact hourly employees. That's just simply, I don't want to set up straw arguments and knock them down, but, there is the point to be made that the FLSA is a bright line. You cannot go below that. Everybody in the small businesses, private sector, is subject to the FLSA, and they are you can't go below that. But moving closer to that, moving consistently with the FLSA allows there to be more of just a one, this is how you do overtime. You don't need to hire an attorney to figure out the two systems, and even though there's the same words, there's different applications. Oops, you got caught. Under the current system, there's kind of a gotcha aspect because it's the same words for the exemptions, but they mean different things. So I think moving that way helps small business. It helps people who want to do business in Alaska because they don't have to do an Alaskan overlay. I mean, you still have the federal law is 40 hours a week as opposed to 8 hours a day and 40 hours a week. That this bill doesn't address that. But so there are some differences, but those are easily calculable differences as opposed to saying, oh, we have a director of marketing that's going to travel between seven stores and run them. We need to have somebody watching them, or they need to bill their time, and we need to review it every day to make sure they're meeting the 80-20 test. That's not, I would guess, what this body intended when it originally passed the exemption language that is identical to the federal exemption language. But what happened is in the regulatory process, the federal DOL had different regulations, the short test, long test, now just one test, and the state just picked up the long test.
Good. That's a good testimony, Representative Ledoux.
Well, I can understand the problems with the 80-20 test, but I'm not sure this forms such a bright line. There would seem to be that there would be some latitude in the terms what their primary duty is in the performance of their work, discretionary and that sort of thing, so that there still might be the he said, she said sort of scenario.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, we don't want to get rid of all the lawyers. No, I'm just...
You'll never do
through
that.
The chair, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that it is correct where you're getting right now where you have, there's always going to be interpretation. I mean, you always have to take the law and apply it to the particular facts. And for as long as the FLSA has been in existence, which is 1938, there has always been the need to apply the particular facts. What this is, it's not that you don't do that under this bill or under the FLSA. It's what you look at. And so if I'm employed as the director of marketing, it is more analytically correct and I think defensible to say, let's look at what duties I'm employed to do, as opposed to me as the director of marketing, I don't have anyone looking over my shoulder, and I can start intentionally or unintentionally, and I'm not trying to, you know, imply anything like that, but I can say, you know what, I spent 6 minutes making coffee. I spent 3 minutes opening the lock. I talked to an employee, which we were just chit-chatting for 10 minutes, and there's an attempt at times, or you're put into a time-based system that doesn't fit with a business organizational chart. So it's not that you don't have to apply the law to the facts, it's that you're applying, looking at the duties and as opposed to the time spent on a particular task. So the regulations, federal regulations, for instance, say, let's talk about the importance of the tasks that the person is employed to do. And if you're a business owner, that's exactly what you do when you hire somebody. You don't say, I want you to spend 37 minutes today making good decisions. You say, I want you to accomplish the task, whether it takes you 37 minutes or 68 minutes. So I don't know that that answers your question, but...
No, I see, follow up. I mean, I see what you're talking about, but I'm just looking at, for example, not the director of marketing. That's not where you really are necessarily going to have the problems. But that person who is engaged in an administrative capacity, who's like C, whose primary duty includes the exercise of discretion and independent judgment with respect to matters of significance. That matters of significance sounds like something that, you know, could be a pension plan for lawyers.
Through the chair, I won't repeat my prior comment. There are interpretive aspects of it, but again, what this bill would do is say, currently, some of that same type of language is in our regulations. So, in our regulations, you still are doing that, and I would just so that the committee understands. The director of marketing, that's exactly the level of employment that this bill addresses. So that vignette, I told you, this is a real story. And there were 2 years of litigation, and then there was a settlement. This bill doesn't address any hourly employee aspect. It addresses the employees who are exempt at a management level. So I do want to make sure that that's clear. The other thing is, back there are my regs, and the state regs are somewhat limited. Those are, well, just to hold them up, those are the federal regs. That's a copy of the federal regs with explanatory notes. Now that's, you know what's nice about that is that that explains all these words and gives examples, and so that's a rich resource to go to, which our State Department of Labor hasn't expended the resource, time, effort, and people hours to develop. I mean, so that's a resource as our systems come closer together that lawyers can go to and advise clients, here's what you have to do, as opposed to saying, well, here are the words that are in the state regulations. There's some letter opinions and things like that, but we don't know. There's not the richness and depth of background for lawyers, for instance, to give their clients quality advice up front to avoid litigation, as opposed to trying to guess what these words might mean later on.
So are you saying that under the current statute, you've got these words basically, and then added to, or something similar to those, and then added to it is the 80-20 test, if I'm understanding?
Well, no, I was looking. Through the chair, Representative Leduc, Representative Roekberg mentioned that our system has become more antiquated, and I think in that this is exactly how that occurs. Is there used to be in land long time ago? You know, there were two systems. There was the long test and the short test, basically. And I'm obviously boiling things down to at some level, but there was the long test and the short test. The short test had the primary duties concept in it, and the long test had the 80-20. That's gone now. There's only one test. And that's more of the primary, not more of that, well, it's, for shortness of time, it's the primary duties concept. You know, what are the duties? And so focus on duties instead of minutes. Now, we have the worst of both worlds in our regulations right now, because if you're a small business person, or any employer for that matter, and you're reading the state test, it says primary duty is management, or primary duty is work directly related to management policies or supervising the general business operations. Those are our regulatory words right then. But, and so you'd go, ooh, that's the same as the FLSA. I'm okay. But then you get further, the more you read, you realize, oh, I've got this 80-20 test pops up. So it's almost a red herring, because it talks about primary duties, but then it says, oh, and also the 80-20 test, which is different from the primary duties test. So right now,
it's a hybrid of the two schemes, of the FLSA and the statutes.
Actually, it's... I don't know. I didn't draft those regulations, so I couldn't speak exactly on that. But I can say that is not correct, because when you have the 80-20 test, that really eliminates the primary duties. So it might have been an attempt to create a hybrid, but in essence what it did was say no matter how much you get paid, and let's remember that when the long test under the federal system was first implemented, it was dealing with people who were making $155 to $249 a week. It hasn't been applied in Alaska in years, because just making minimum wage puts you over that. So it was designed for people who would barely qualify as exempt. But to say it's a hybrid would assume that there's a mixture, and it's not. It's you drop to the lowest level, which is the 80-20. So you could really just, I tell employers, scratch out that primary duties test. Just look at the 80-20.
Does that make sense? Okay, how about last question?
Just one more question. You bet. In there. And that is, and so under this new statute or the old statute, that only applies to people who are making salaries. It doesn't apply to people who are on an hourly wage.
Yes, you. Excuse me, through the chair, Representative Leduc, you can only qualify for an exemption if you are salaried.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point. Is anything we're doing here, would that be an incentive to an employer to switch to a salary rather than hourly? A charge nurse now that supervises a couple of certified nurse assistants and all, but she's a nurse and that's what she's doing, is her duties as a nurse, but she also directs other people. Would it be beneficial to the employer now to say, okay, you're on a salary and I can continue to work you 12 hours a day, but I only have to pay you as a salary based on 8? Or is there any unintended consequence here by doing this that you can see?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, no, I don't believe that's so, because this is a multi tiered test, and so paying somebody's salary doesn't get you to the line. You still have to do, you have to prove the exemption, you have to establish the exemption through the duty. And that's what I personally find very beneficial to employers and, frankly, employees, because clarity is always a goal as opposed to vagueness, which creates litigation. But the by moving more towards the FLSA, you have 70 years of case law that you can. I don't know the answer to the charge nurse thing, but I could find it. I have hundreds, I think it's 258 pages of regulations and examples that I can go, look, they've addressed that. There was, as I'm sure members of the committee know, is when we went through this this new regulatory scheme over the last couple of years, the Federal Department of Labor received tens of thousands of comments, and they addressed many of them in their in the regulations and the commentary for the regulations. And so what this does is gives us a bigger resource, a richer resource to check and get the correct answer up front, as opposed to having somewhat skeletal regulatory definitions that leave many questions unanswered. So I don't know if I answered your question. But
to that end, and just briefly, so hypothetically you have ABC hamburgers, and you have, going with Representative Crawford's question or concern, an individual who has supervisory ability but is working a lot of overtime and acting as a supervisor, and through this bill, could you then say, no, now you'll be the supervisor and I'll give you a salary and work you, you know, 18 hours a day, and thank goodness now I don't have to pay the overtime. I think that's what he's getting at. Will you see a shift of employees going from hourly to supervisory because now you will skip the overtime payment?
excuse me, Chairman Anderson. I can't predict the future. I don't see that because it's one test of several. First of all, secondly, the problem, based on my experience, I've been practicing law for 16 years up here or thereabouts, but the problem is the people you think are exempt are, and I've got another answer to that too that I think I'll clarify, but the problem is the people you think are exempt and are the directors and are the managers that come back to bite you after, usually, you know, a separation or something like that. The other thing is the FLSA, and I'll use the FLSA as an example. There's it's the same in state law, but the hedge against that, or the fence against that, is that no employer that I work with, period, bar none, wants to push that envelope. The penalties are so severe that ABC hamburger, you go, I'm going to go save a few bucks and try to move somebody who's truly an hourly employee into a salary position. Let's go back to what I said a little earlier. You're looking at potentially, 2 years times their overtime times 1.5 times their salary plus the cost of litigation on your that you pay as the employer plus the reasonable actuals of the other side, attorney fees, and that can. In a world long time ago, I used to represent plaintiffs, and just as by way of example, I represented somebody, and this will just give you kind of the idea of why an employer would not do that. I represented somebody, a plaintiff, so an employee, who had approximately a $12,000 to $15,000 overtime claim. After about 3 or 4 or 5 months of litigation, some depositions, no motion practice that I can recall. I mean, I'd have to go check, but I don't recall any motion practice. We settled for like $65,000. So that's not a big case, but what that shows you is no employer, no reasonable, rational employer is going to want to take those kind of risks. That's not a good business risk. And to the extent any employer does that, they get hammered. I mean, that is... So I don't know if that's answering your question.
No, that's good. We're going a little long here, but purposely, I think, because I think you're getting into the minutia of the bill. Representative Crawford or Guttenberg, question?
Oh, just your last comment, but it happens all the time, doesn't it? I mean, that's why we have lawyers, because people push the envelope with employees. And I mean, it goes both ways. There's no doubt about it. But, And if I may, there's got to be a lot of case law on this to define a lot of some of the parameters. Hasn't there been in, over the years?
Federally, yes.
And not on state.
Not
staff.
Nearly. I mean, not even in close. I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Gutenberg. Not even close to what you have on the federal level, because the penalties in Alaska are more severe. So you get more forced settlement, even where the employer would rather litigate than settle. They have a more difficult time doing that. And I guess, to the extent that, going back to, I think, the question you were referring to, the one about does this create an incentive, I don't think any analytical or rational thought to that applying to that bill would result in that, because you can't, it's a multi-tiered test, and so merely changing somebody to salary doesn't achieve the rest of the test, and you can't do it without exposing yourself greatly. And there are plenty of lawyers out there looking for opportunities to bring those plaintiffs-type lawsuits. So I don't think, I might not be answering your question, but there is no, by saying we're going to move from 80-20 to primary duties, yeah, you don't have to, you're not going to look at the time anymore, so that's a given. Although primary duties implies, you know, 50% or 51%, but there's other definitions of it also developed in case law and regulations. What it says is instead of looking at minutes, we're going to look at duties. But there's still other tests that have to be achieved.
So under, under executive capacity, management of an enterprise which employers employ a custom recognized department, maybe you're the grill manager.
Excuse me?
Maybe you're the grill manager. You're flipping burgers. You got two people working for you. Somebody's doing short orders. Somebody's doing sous chef. Two or more employees. The last part is that you're influential in advancement or hiring or firing or just in giving particular weight on employees. You know, fire the guy. He's, you know, tell him the manager or the owner. I mean, theoretically, I mean, what's problematic is the bottom end of the scale, not, you know, for me, the top end is another. But Representative Crawford's comment, you know, incentives to hire people under umbrellas and change their status and things that would normally be, you just pay them straight time because they are salaried employees, hourly employees, and you find incentive just in this little test here under executive capacity that you could do that. And somebody would think of doing that, and many employees are just intimidated by their bosses and say, you're now in charge of the grill, these guys work for you, I'm going to give you a little bit of raise, and now you're going to work 60 or 70 hours a week. And you've got to.
Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, first of all, if we're talking about hamburger flippers, they would be, this is the protection. I mean, under the federal, again, you have two systems. Under the federal, they'd have to be paid $4.55 to qualify per week. Under the state, you're going to have to pay them two times minimum wage. So I think when you talk about the lower end, you can't have that discussion without realizing that you are going to pay. I mean, in the end, businesses are in business. They don't want to pay somebody more just to call them exempt. I mean, it becomes more costly to try to make somebody exempt running a great risk as opposed to making them hourly and paying them what the going rate is for a hamburger flipper. So I think that that's an issue that you have to look at if you're going to talk about the lower end is...
Anybody hungry?
Yes. And the other thing is, this is not... The federal system, either the federal current federal test or the short test, which looks at primary duties, has been adopted by 40-plus states. 40 states, and I haven't done this review since last spring, and I think that there's some movement, some more movement, so I may revise those numbers. But 40 states are using a primary duties-based test, and I am not aware, and I can only speak about circulars I get and when I go to conferences, there has not been an explosion in those states of problems at that lower end of the scale, partly because of the 455 minimum, and up here the protection is the two times. So I don't know how to answer your question other than that.
And I think we've been somewhat duplicative in terms of Representative Crawford and the Guttenberg. It's a valid question, but I think you've answered it as best of your ability. John, I'm going to push you aside now, and we're going to go a little beyond what I wanted to do, but people have been waiting here for now an hour and a half, and so I'm going to go 8 more minutes, and I'd ask that they could each keep their response to maybe 2 minutes. That would be great, and if they have really compelling testimony, they can submit it in writing as well. So we'll next go here in the committee room to Wayne Stevens, Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, then Randy Kerr, Rob Morris, Kara Fox, and wrap it up with Jack Amon. Sorry, Wayne, to make it quick, but just so we can get to the next.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Wayne Stevens. I'm the president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. Just want to let you know that we support the efforts to provide definitions for persons employed in administrative, executive, and professional capacities. I think Mr. Cedar has covered the technical aspects of the bill quite well. Point out that the minimum wage in this state is $7.15 an hour, so you're talking someone that's making $14.30 an hour, and I'm not aware of many hamburger flippers that are making $14.30 an hour, but state chamber's on record in supporting this, and with that I'd excuse myself. And
thanks, Wayne.
Keep it short.
Okay, we'll go next to Randy Kerr online.
My name is Randy Carr. I formerly worked for the Alaska Department of Labor for 28 years. For the last 20 of those, I managed the wage and hour administration for the department. I'm now a consultant in private practice, and I am testifying on my own behalf. I would like to compliment the committee for some of the thoughtful questions on this bill. There are some pitfalls that I wanted to point out, and I have submitted my testimony in writing. There will be a lot more detail than I'll be able to give in 2 minutes, but I want to touch on the high points. The questions posed by Representative Ledoux as to the meaning of primary duty go right to the heart of the matter. This bill is actually adopting verbatim the language found in the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act definitions, but it only grabs pieces of it. There are component elements within those definitions that are defined in the federal regulations that are either not defined under state law or are defined differently under state law, which leaves the employer in a position of either having two sets of definitions to comply with, one of which will be more stringent than the other, or just hoping that whatever he does under federal law is going to satisfy the state. And a prime example of that is the term primary duty. It sounds as though primary duty means something that's done 51% of the time. But that would be the case under the state policy. The state has for years enforced primary duty as that activity that's performed more than 50% of the time. That is not, however, the definition under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. And I have attached with my written submissions copies of fact sheets from the Fair Labor Standards Act Department of Labor webpage, which gives those definitions. But just briefly, the primary duty in the federal law means the principal, main, major, or most important duty that the employee performs. Determination of employee's primary duty must be based on all the facts of a particular case with a major emphasis on the character of the employee's job as a whole. Now, under the old regulations, there was an exemption known as the sole charge exemption, which allowed an employee who had a primary duty of an exempt nature in the executive area to perform 90% non-exempt work and still qualify for the exemption. That sole charge exemption has gone away under the new regulations, but the whole concept of the sole charge is still alive in the definition of primary duty found in the federal regulations.
Mr. Carr, I'm going to interrupt you real quick. This is Chairman Anderson. The committee members are desperately looking for the document. You say you've submitted it or intend to submit it?
I have given it to the LIO staff here. I don't know that they have faxed it.
Okay, so it's en route. It may not be here for your testimony now, but we'll have a copy of that. Okay, go ahead and continue.
And other terms that are creating will or have created similar problems are the term particular weight, as used in the executive definition. That is defined in federal regulations. There's no definition in state regulations. The term customarily and regularly is used in the executive and outside sales exemptions, not defined in state regs. Discretion and independent judgment in the administrative exemption, not defined. Matters of significance, as used in the administrative exemption, which is a very key term, not defined in state regulations. There are definitions for all of these terms or explanations as to their meaning in the new federal regulations. I'm hopeful that the state will take this opportunity to consider those thoughtfully and adopt those meanings that they intend in concert with this bill as they move it forward. One last thing, there is another exemption in the new federal regulations that is not represented in this bill, and that is the exemption for the highly paid employee. It is referenced in the administrative and executive and professional exemptions, but it's also spelled out separately in the federal definitions. And that is an individual who receives $100,000 a year, who performs office or non-manual work, who receives as part of that $100,000 a year a salary that has the minimum established under the federal law, and they customarily and regularly perform at least one of the exempt duties of an administrator, executive, or professional. Those individuals under the federal law are just not eligible for overtime at all. And that's an important exemption, and it's spelled out as part of the others as well. I think it needs to be read in concert with the others because it makes the package whole and makes the package make more sense. And I would hope the committee would consider that as a possible addition to this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Randy. We'll definitely look forward to reviewing that as the LAO submits it to my committee aide, and he'll duplicate that for us. So we'll next go to Rob Morris.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, representatives. My name is Robert Morris. I'm Director of Human Resources for Alaska Children's Services and also serve as Legislative Co-Chair for Anchorage Society of Human Resource Management. I would like to begin by stating I am in support of HB 182 for the following couple of reasons. As an HR human resource professional, I'm dedicated to following federal and state laws. The current state statutes relating to the Wage and Hour Act are difficult to interpret at times and thereby open to misinterpretation. I would greatly appreciate having clearer definitions of the classifications in order to avoid making mistakes that impact my employees and my agency. Second point, with the FLISA, or Fair Labor Standards Act, fair pay revisions implemented last year, I believe the Alaska statutes would benefit from these proposed amendments, given that they are better streamlined with the federal regulations. Many small to medium-sized organizations just lack the resources to devote towards interpreting the ambiguous wording, in particularly the 80-20 rule that Mr. Sedor has already addressed. This bill would eliminate the 80-20 test and assist such employers operating within the definitions by providing clearer classifications and resulting in fewer costly mistakes impacting employees and employers alike. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Appreciate it. Thanks for waiting so long to testify. Kara Fox. Kara, could you please speak up for the committee and try to get your get the microphone closer to you?
Okay, I think we got it now.
Oh, perfect.
Sorry about that. Again, I'll start over. I'm the Director of Human Resources and Administration for Hawaiian Vacations. I'm also the co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Anchorage Society of Human Resource Management. And again, I'll also start out by saying that we are in support of this bill. I think this is an important amendment given that most of the businesses in Alaska are small businesses. Which has already been brought up. Small businesses generally do not have the headcount or financial ability to ensure that someone whose primary purpose is doing exempt-level work meets the 80-20 rule that's currently part of the state law. Therefore, they face unnecessary risk, as Mr. Sedor has talked about, anytime someone is classified as exempt. In addition, it used to be that the state law was always more strict than the federal law. With the new FLSA federal rules, that's no longer the case, which means we now have to muddle through both laws trying to determine whether an employee qualifies as exempt or not. And this is quite a hassle, can be very confusing. An example in our own company is our reservations manager, who is responsible for the day-to-day management of our largest department in the company and who has the authority to influence hiring and firing and disciplinary actions, make judgment calls, and really has a big part in the management of the company. She also helps out by taking reservation calls when our phones are really busy, which is considered a non-exempt level duty. In fact, all of the directors of our company do the same thing when we're really slammed with calls. By doing so, she puts her exempt level status in jeopardy, and we as a company take a large risk. On the other hand, based on her primary duties and responsibilities, it wouldn't really make sense to make her a non-exempt employee. So this is simply just part of operating a small business. My own position is also a good example. I'm a director of the company, yet I'm also an HR department of one person, which means inevitably I do all my own filing, data entry, et cetera, et cetera. In a large company, that would be done by a separate non-exempt worker. So by under current law, I could argue that my employer owed me back wages for overtime by saying that I spent over 20% of my time doing this non-exempt work. Being able to stay efficient with our human resources and keep costs under control is what allows us to survive as a small local business. But because of current state law, there is a possibility that an employee could manipulate this 80-20 rule, intentionally or unintentionally, and bring a very damaging suit against us. We're constantly at risk, even though we make a very good faith effort to classify our employees correctly. In addition, with the current disparity between state and federal law, many employers are confused about what they're supposed to do, which makes compliance very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you, Kara. Appreciate your testimony. Last but not least, our friend Jack Amon from Marks Brothers, and I believe you're still president of ARBA. If you could,
actually, I'm now past chairman. They finally put me out to pasture.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you, my friend, to keep it in like a minute because we're going to have to go here shortly. I'm so sorry, and you
That's
can obviously
right.
send a letter.
New York, speak for you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 182. The changes made in the duties test for exempt employees is a great stride forward in modernizing Alaska's labor laws to more accurately reflect the current workplace. A change that I might add the federal government realized was long overdue and adopted this past year. In many food service and hospitality businesses, the current duties test for exempt employees does not match the reality of the workplace. This is especially true in small businesses where all employees and owners wear many hats. The current 80-20 test used in Alaska is so onerous and restrictive that it's forced most operators to keep all employees, including those who head departments or supervise others, hourly. This can have a negative impact on both the employer and the employee. The employees affected by this change in the law represent our highest paid and highest skilled workers. Due to the increased cost of benefits, such as health insurance, we as a small business have changed our benefit plans to only salaried employees because of the large number of hourlies we employ. And now we have employees we would like to be able to move to exempt status so we could get them under these plans, but can't. In my entire business, I have maybe two employees that I could move over into the exempt status whose duties would qualify. In my mind, if one has the authority to hire and fire and is responsible for the work of others, they are managers, whether they manage from behind a stove or behind a desk. I often manage my restaurant with my hands in the dish sink. I'm afraid that opponents of this bill will state that this is an attempt by business owners to cheat hardworking employees out of the overtime they deserve. Nothing could be farther from the truth. In order to run a successful business, it is essential to retain top-quality employees. These top workers know their worth and demand for their skills. One could not keep them long by taking advantage of them. This change in statute will allow more flexibility for both employers and employees to make compensation arrangements that are beneficial to both. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Jack. I don't see anyone else wishing to testify in Anchorage.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
What's your name?
Legacki, Ken Legacki.
Okay, Ken, I'll give you 1 minute.
I'm against the bill, and it seems kind of unfair to only get 1 minute when almost an hour has been given for it. But
I'll give you two minutes.
First of all the testing I've heard has been contrary to the purpose and policy of this bill, which is to protect employees, which is to protect single mothers with children that have to go pick up the kids from daycare, single fathers or young parents. And real quickly, we talk about the other 40 states. Now, Ms. Ledoux is from Kodiak. Is it fair to compare an employee in Kodiak to somebody in Alabama, Mississippi, or Louisiana when we have to pay extra costs and extra money to have goods and other stuff sent to Kodiak or other parts of Alaska? Alaska's a unique state, and since statehood, our fathers have always recognized that. And I've always recognized that workers in Alaska need special protection. And I heard, never Mr. Cedar talks about one example of some district manager going around to seven places. That is, I don't think of any, that's really quite an anomaly. What happens is what a little bit you heard here if somebody wants to name somebody a manager or give them a title, but then have them do tremendous amount of hourly work. I am a lawyer, as Mr. Rokeberg has mentioned to me, and I think everybody's got a copy of the exchange of our emails. I, for example, Rite Aid would name people managers, but have them unload trucks, do stocking and of goods and so forth, but would not pay them overtime because they had the titles of manager. It's the same thing with Fred Meyer, same thing with Kenny Shoes, the same thing with Foot Locker. And that's what they try to do with these employees. I look at it in a different way. When I look at some of what I hear about what I see employers, I look at it as an employer who goes, compared to somebody going down the block in the street and breaking into houses and stealing things. And then if I come up to somebody breaking into my house and say, hey, that's my stereo and that's my TV, and then the burglar goes, well, I'll tell you what, we'll make a deal here. I'll take the TV and you keep the stereo. And that's what happens in these cases. A lot of these employers will try to stretch and not pay their employees overtime. And then when they get caught, we'll negotiate a deal. Now, all they have to do is call the Department of Labor and say, here is what my employee's doing. Is he exempt or non-exempt? It's not that difficult. It's really not. The 20% of the if you're looking at somebody, if they're doing a one day out of a 5 day week, if they're doing hourly work, then they're supposed to get overtime. How many hours are these people working? If you give an employer an excuse to allow these employees to work 60, 70 hours a week and still get a salary, that harms the employee. We're not talking about 1 hour or 2 hour or 3 hours of overtime a week. Nobody files suit for that. We're talking about a constant week of 50 to 60, 70 hours. Look at Mr. Rokeberg. Mr. Rokeberg talks about LAMEX shutting down. I don't know if Mr. Rokeberg's been to LAMEX, but nobody was visiting LAMEX anymore. It was not because of overhead. It was because they're not getting any business. They also have two other restaurants that are doing very well. It's just that the service and the quality of food at LAMEX has really dropped down, and that's why it shut down. They just didn't have any business.
Okay, I've given you 4 minutes. Thank you. Is there any questions? I'm a friend of the owner of LAMEX, so that rubs me wrong. Also, in terms of your comment, you have the right to give your hypotheticals, but to say that your hypothetical was that the employers are thieves, I don't know if that's applicable to the bill, and I don't think that was a good example.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, I think we've heard it coming from the other side too, about all the employees suing for non-substantive reasons because they, all of these stories, all of these bills have two sides to it. Lozanski's the only person that we've heard speak up against it. Mr. Carr, I'm not quite sure. But,
do you have a question to him?
Well, I'm just referring to your comments to Ms. Lozanski. We've heard stories about restaurants closing for a variety of reasons, and your comments to him back I don't think were appropriate.
Thank you. Okay, are there any questions for him? No. Okay, is there anyone else in the committee room that wishes to testify? Seeing, hearing none, I'll close the public hearing, and I'll ask for a motion to move the bill out of committee. Representative Rokeberg.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to motion then, just to get the discussion going. Make a motion to remove CS House Bill 182 out of committee with individual recommendations, accompanying fiscal note.
Objection?
Yeah, I object.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg objects. Debate?
I think Ms. Lozanski made a lot of good points. I think, we've heard from businesses, and they're concerned. There's a variety of people out there. Myself, might not be shorter cooks, might be people working on the slope, but I've seen a lot of cases and a lot of opportunities where people were abused on the job. It goes both ways. There are good employees and bad ones, and there's good employers and bad ones. I think this is opening a door to more abuses, to ask people to do more for less. And I think that's a major consideration in how we go about our business. You know, we heard the Rotary rules yesterday on the floor. You know that they're four rules. I think those are a major consideration how we deal with these things. But I think I would have liked to have seen a side by side between the Fair Labor Standard Act and what this does, and how things are changed, and what's in it and what's not in it, and how it's represented. You know, when you're talking about employees, I just think we're opening things up. We heard how hard it is on one case to get an opinion. And then we heard in another case that you can just call the Department of Labor and they will tell you who is exempt and who isn't. I'm not sure what's broken here. I haven't seen it. I just see somebody wants to change. You know, we with the restaurant stories, last year we heard one, a restaurant was closed because of the increase in minimum wage. Now we have one here that a restaurant is closing because of labor costs. But I'm not from Anchorage, but I've talked to people, and in both cases, they violated the three rules of restaurant. It was location, location, location. You're in the wrong place, you won't succeed. And then we hear excuses, it's on the backs of the employees. I find that offensive. In both of those cases, you had two other successful restaurants. In the third one, it's the employees' fault. Those people are interchanged. I don't see changing state law on the back of working people, working families. A lot of times, the people on the bottom end are single parents, single moms, trying to make ends meet. Now, we're going to try to make it harder for them, and I think that's what's going to result from this bill.
Appreciate your
Mr. Chairman.
Comments, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had an unemployment insurance bill here that we held for another meeting so that we could get more information because there were questions that needed to be answered. I would like to see what Mr. Carr's comments were. I'd like to hear more about this bill. I don't feel the need to move it today. I would appreciate a little more time on this. I may end up voting for this bill. I don't feel comfortable at this point. I think it was unfortunate, the exchange over LAMEX. You know, there are two sides to the story. I don't know what unintended consequences we have here yet. I'm concerned. I spent time when I was in high school working for a hamburger joint where they would work me 80 to 100 hours a week before was covered by the Fair Labor Standards. That didn't happen until 1976. I know that people will take advantage of you. I have been taken advantage of. I don't want to take a step back in time. I want to be sure what I'm doing before I move forward.
Representative Roofberg?
Well, Chairman, I just would say, I'd ask the committee to consider there's nothing in this bill that's intended to hurt or injure Alaskan workers. Absolutely nothing. And any implication to that, I truly resent. Because what this bill does is remove what's called the long test. The other definitional descriptions of what those exempt capacities are either very similar or much like what's in the law now. So this rhetoric about hurting workers and so forth, really this has to do with the 80-20 rule and what we can requiring employers to run around and prove the 80-20 provisions. That's what the real big distinction is here, frankly. I think that the workers, and as Mr. Cedar points out, that the workers will be better protected if they look at the case law and the regulatory law that's been built up in both the federal and state level. Now, I could have come out and introduced the federal regulations. I did not do that intentionally. What I was trying to do is respect the work that the Department of Labor and the case law and the law of the state of Alaska had done for so long. And on the other hand, meld in the newer federal regulations where appropriate. That's why there's not a blanket adoption. And frankly, I was trying to listen to the members of organized labor that had some concerns about just a blanket adoption of those federal rules.
So what we tried to do here is balance this properly. Take the look at the good portions of the Alaska Code and modify them only slightly, and to try to bring them in greater conformance with the federal law to have a similar pattern so employers wouldn't be so have such a difficulty when looking at two sets of laws they have to conform with, but still respecting our law here. So there's nothing in here that hurts the worker, but unless you make the case that you have to have the long test or that 80-20 rule to protect the worker. And I believe, and as the testimony I think is presented to this committee, is more than adequate to say that that is adequate. It doesn't work anymore. Plus the fact that this committee in the last legislature has already raised the standard to twice the minimum wage. It's $29,774. That's a guarantee minimum threshold that anybody who's going to be exempt and gets that status has that protection. And that's a huge difference, and another reason we didn't adopt the federal rule. And frankly, the side, but there is a side-by-side in there, but it's the current law and Alaska law. And then I just put the Lamex article in the file. The point I was making about the article is that the legislature has created these obstacles and problems. I wasn't pointing that out specifically. Mr. Legacki misinterpreted the reason I even mentioned that here. I wasn't making a claim that the labor laws had caused them to go out of work. I didn't make that statement at all. I was just saying that there's a historic pattern here that businesses have been burdened by actions of the legislature over this period of time. So at any rate, I believe that the one thing I will indicate to the committee, Mr. Carr's reputation as a member of the Department of Labor for a number of years, I respect some of his positions. I'd be more than willing to look at what he has to say. In essence, the gist of it is, he says, why don't you just go ahead and adopt the federal standards? But what I will be able to do before we have another hearing in the Finance Committee is to look at that and see if there's a real reason to make those changes. And I'll even talk to organized labor about it and what they feel about the thing.
And I would just delineate, Representative Crawford, I'll let you speak, and then Representative Ledoux, and we have to be brief. The Speaker's Chief of Staff is asking to move. Okay, so we'll have to go up. But I feel that there's a difference in that bill because we held it for statistical analysis and some other things that extra day, and I think this is somewhat of a different circumstance where philosophically you may disagree, but not because there's pertinent information. And Mr. Carr was aware we were going to have this hearing for 4 days. He chose to fax it 30 minutes ago or an hour ago, so I don't know why he waited that long, but I think it still has another committee of referral, and we can continue the process, and you'll get a copy, of course, of all that testimony. It's Paxton today. Do you have a quick comment?
Chairman, to just clear up one point, you say that we raised it to double the minimum wage. I believe that just last year we dropped it from 2.5 times the minimum wage down to 2 times the minimum wage, so I don't see how that's really a raise, if I remember that correctly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, remember I put it in statute. We had an agreement on it. Plus, it made it applicable to all workers in the state, not just that one category. So it actually protected a lot more workers didn't have that protection previously.
Okay, we have to end debate here. Now we'll have a roll call vote because I presume the objection is maintained.
Sure.
Okay. If we could have a vote, Mr. Secretary, you can just go down the line if you want.
Representative Crawford?
No.
Representative Lynch?
Yes.
Representative Kopp?
Yeah.
Chairman?
Yes.
Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
I was
5-2.
Okay, so the House Bill, what is the number? I forget already. House Bill 182 passes out of committee with individual recommendations, and it will go on to finance, and some of these questions can be answered in that process, and we will distribute all of the information faxed. We are adjourned at 5:15.